I'm Louise Adler, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this keynote lecture in the Festival of Ideas. I was thrilled when the festival director, Patrick McCackie, asked me to introduce Kate tonight. Little did he know that I had been a devotee of Kate Grenville's work since her very first book of short stories, the gloriously titled Bearded Ladies. I think, though, that he heard my shriek of joy down the telephone at the invitation, because ever since he's been exhorting me to keep my introductory remarks short. But how can I be succinct when the Grenville canon, or oeuvre, I've now introduced Kate to the idea that she has an oeuvre, and she's totally delighted by the notion. But we all knew she had an oeuvre, but the oeuvre is some 8 novels and 4 non-fiction works. So Patrick can glower all he wants. I'm going to enjoy the evening. So in thinking about Kate Grenville's writing over the past 25 years, there have been some threads that have been there, it seems to me, from the very outset. There is the most distinctive Grenville view of the world. It's sharp, it's clear-eyed, it's wryly comic, it's always empathic and humane. It seemed to me, thinking about Kate's work, that it was those threads that remained resolutely present throughout the entire oeuvre. I'll keep on repeating the word so she can become used to the idea. Recently, though, Kate explained that she sets herself the task of thinking, what would I have done in the place of these characters? It's the novelist's art to take us readers to that precise question, and I think it has been Grenville's project from the very earliest of her writing. One of my favourite novels, and I have many Grenville favourite novels, but one of my dearest novels, if you like, is Joan Makes History. Some of you may remember the novel, and I hope it is still in print. It's a riotously entertaining counter-history. The everywoman Joan is inserted into the grand masculinist narrative of Australia's past. And this transgressive act, that bringing together of sexual politics and history, they collide in a dramatic dialogue that I think is one of the central themes of all of Grenville's work. And I hope you'll forgive me if I read you just a little of the last page of Joan Makes History. I thought my story was one the world had never heard before. I loved and was bored. I betrayed and was forgiven. I ran away and returned. And all these things appeared to be personal and highly significant history. Oh, Joan, what bogus grandeur. There was not a single joy I could feel that countless Joans had not already felt. Not a single mistake I could make that had not been made by some Joan before me. There was a time when I would have raged against such a thought or grown petulant. But now that I'm such an old woman and so many times a grandmother, I do not grieve, but grow pleased and plump at the idea. I swell like an egg. There is nothing I cannot claim as my own. And although you may not think so to look at me, I am the entire history of the globe walking down the street. I am weary and old now, pushing the squeaking pram and considering my life, and what a paltry thing it is. I wish I had known earlier that I was making history. If I had, I might have lived more carefully and with my eye on the past and the future rather than on myself alone. Soon I will be part of the dirt along with all the other things that have had their day. This hand, freckled with years of sunlight, these feet in their sensible shoes, this spine curved over the child in the pram will be a scattering of loose bones before long, and this skull that had been home to so many imagined lives will become a receptacle of nothing more grand than another handful or two of dirt. Such lugubrious thoughts should trouble me, but do not. I savour my share of life. Around me in the mauve dusk, I can hear a child screeching at the idea of bedtime, a woman singing over the dishes clattering in the sink, and someone somewhere is having a good sneeze. Long after I'm dirt, there will still be such people screeching and singing and sneezing away, and I will always be part of them. Stars blazed, protozoa coupled, apes levered themselves upright, generations of women and men lived and died, and like them all I, Joan, have made history. It seems to me to be such a quintessential Grenville moment, that moment of explaining oneself, one's femininity, one's idea of being female into history. And then there was Lillian's story, in which Kate Grenville took the extraordinary and very real eccentric Bea Miles and imagined a biography for her into being. It's the story, as you'll remember, of a young girl at odds with the misogynistic Edwardian world into which she's been born. Lillian's story is a story of a Sydney bag lady, but it's a story in which Kate Grenville has imagined a life. She's invented a life for this particular eccentric, imagined what's now called a backstory. Nearly a decade later, Kate would return to the story of Lillian and write a remarkable, what we now call a prequel, called Dark Places. And it's my favourite novel. It's the novel I failed to win. I was reminding Kate, she says, I took her out to lunch. I don't remember lunch. I just remember the loss of failing to win, persuading Kate to come to Heinemann. But it is, I think, one of the most important novels about sexuality that has been written in Australia. It reminds me of my brilliant career, and it reminds me of Christina Stead's For Love Alone. But it is a very dark place, dark places. It's dark, and it sets out to understand the masculine impulse. If Lillian's story explored the effects of sexual abuse, Dark Places is concerned with the fear and loathing of women, the sense of entitlement that men have, and the unrestrained sexual drive that would drive a father to rape his daughter. It's a devastating account, and I certainly remember that at the time, many a reviewer was made uncomfortable. It was very pleasurable to watch the discomfort in print, but they were certainly rendered uncomfortable by Dark Places. But in those early novels, she was already playing with the relationship between the real world and the fictional world. B. Miles was a real person, but Lillian's story an imaginative act. And in more recent years, the publication of The Secret River and The Lieutenant has, as we all know, engendered a lively debate about the very relationship of history to fiction. Historians seem to be worrying away at Kate Grenville's novels. Has she dared to usurp the role of the historian? Is The Secret River faux history, ersatz history? Perhaps I think this is a dilemma that arises out of a very proper anxiety or angst that surrounds the historian's task. After all, writing is an act of interpretation, reading the evidence and reflecting upon that evidence and coming up with an analysis. Writing history to state the bleeding obvious now is never objective or a mere statement of facts, and the best historians emphasise the partiality and provisionality of their own reading of the past. So the question is why this anxiety, why this concern with Kate Grenville writing about the past when she quite explicitly states that it is not history writing. I think maybe, and I say this with some members of, I think, the history department here, but the family of the Faculty of Arts, that perhaps the anxiety around this has got more to do with history writing, more to do with some of the questions that confront the discipline of history, more to do with territorial arm wrestling than to do with a proper engagement with the act of making and writing fiction. In her latest novel, The Lieutenant, Kate Grenville takes the problem of Australia's history and reworks it in a wonderfully evocative and imaginative exchange between a British seaman and a young Indigenous girl. Language, creating a shared understanding, is rendered as a wonderfully rich metaphor for the challenge that white and Indigenous Australians still confront today. And then alongside this massive fictional project, the oeuvre, there are the writing books, the text that Kate has delivered on the act of writing, on what it means to write, how one begins to imagine oneself as a writer. And I think it's very interesting that all the way through her writing of fiction, she's continued to publish work about the process. I think it is to lay bare what others would rather not lay bare, and I think it's been immensely valuable to students of creative writing. So I think we owe her an immense gratitude. There are very few writers in Australia today who have taken the time to reflect so frankly on the process. And I think her writing books give us lay readers a real insight into how a good novel is made while offering a practical guide to the aspiring novelist. The latest project in that genre was The Search for the Secret River, which she published, I think, in 2005, after writing The Secret River. It was partly a memoir, but it also shared the process with us. It showed us what the process of writing was all about, from the work of research, trawling through the archives and records, through to creating a work of fiction. As we know, Kate's won countless awards, the Commonwealth Prize for Literature, the Orange Prize, I think every state literary award in the nation, the list goes on and on. But equally important for people like me in the publishing business, she's one of very few Australian writers to have found an audience overseas. And it is an inspiring thought indeed to think of Kate Grenville, such a thoroughly Australian voice, irreverent, highly intelligent and humane, taking our history to a whole world of readers. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Kate Grenville tonight to you to speak on The Writer in a Time of Change. Thank you.
Louise, thank you so much for that exhaustive overview of my work. And the idea of myself having an oeuvre and being described as Grenville, this is going to take some getting used to, but I think I could handle it. Yes, thank you. I'm going to begin tonight by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're gathered to do this talking business, and to acknowledge the elders, both past and present, of those groups. Writers in a time of change. I recently went to a lecture at the Academy of Science in Canberra on geothermal power. I looked around, it was a very different audience from the ones I usually talk to. It was mainly scientists, I guessed. They all had sort of hatchet faces, their eyes blazed with intelligence, pretty much like this one, really. Afterwards, I got talking to the man sitting next to me. It turned out he was a retired professor of physics. I probably wouldn't have started talking to him had I known that. But anyway, when I told him I was a writer, his face lit up. He said, "Ah, you writers, you are the people the planet needs. You must write about this lecture that we've just heard. You must get the message out." And at this point, he obviously thought, she's only a writer, I'd better spell it out in simple words. The message is, just four words, coal is too cheap. Get that into every newspaper and every magazine. Well, I thought I'd better confess. I said, well, actually, I'm not that sort of writer. He peered at me as if this was an impossibility. Actually, I had to admit, I'm a fiction writer. I write novels. His face fell. Fiction? You write novels? He turned away. I was of no more interest to him. So, coal is too cheap. That was the message that was going to save the planet, and I was not the person who was going to get that message out. And he's probably right. As far as I know, the cheapness of coal has never been the subject of a novel. I was stung by his dismissal. My pride was hurt, and on the way home, I toyed with the idea of writing the great Coal is Too Cheap novel. Well, one of you in this room may even now be putting the finishing touches to your great novel of coal and its fatal cheapness. And I hope so, because frankly, I couldn't see any way to do it. A man and a woman in bed together. "Darling, I've been thinking, coal is too cheap." "Absolutely, sweetheart. And did you know that in 2007, geothermal power produced 14,885 gigawatt hours of electricity? Then came the invitation to present this lecture, Writers in a Time of Change. As the hatchet-faced old gentleman had made so painfully clear, the value of the kind of writing that I do is not easy to assert in that context, in spite of the wonderful things that Louise has just said about my oeuvre. See, I could get used to this. I pictured this man skeptically listening to whatever rather feeble thoughts I might have and decided to say no. Then there was a spell of hot, dry, windy weather where I live. It seemed it would never rain again. Weeds turned up their toes. All over my garden, things were dying. Even the bamboo was wilting. That's how bad it was. Of course, it did rain eventually, and I went for a walk just to enjoy the rare sight of water dropping out of the sky. The gutters were streaming with dark water, which was really just mud, I realised. I saw that everywhere plants had died, the topsoil was being scoured away and leaving a brick-hard clay subsoil in which no seed would ever be able to take root. And I suddenly understood that within a very few years, without anything very remarkable happening in any one week, my leafy suburb could become a landscape of barren dust, like the pictures of Iraq that we see on the news. It could happen. And in fact, I realised it had happened, because somewhere around Iraq is where the Garden of Eden used to be. Even someone who can't really quite get their head around what a gigawatt hour is can understand that, and it made me think I will have to say yes to that lecture. A catastrophe is going to overwhelm us unless we do something by tomorrow. The scientists there seems to be pretty much a consensus on that. Getting together to talk about our individual helplessness seems a good place to start feeling less helpless. As Inge Klendinen, the historian, puts it, we know what we as individuals feel, but we cannot know whether we are idiosyncratic. To investigate that, we have to formulate thoughts into words and then offer them for discussion. That's what I'm going to do tonight. And, of course, in tomorrow's panel session, well, both the panel sessions, I suppose, the poets and the novelist, will take these ideas, I presume, a little further. First, though, I'll go back to that word I used so glibly a moment ago, catastrophe. We're at the end of a week when a lot of seriously smart people have been talking about things quantifiable. But how should those quantities be interpreted? Is there really the catastrophe looming that I mentioned? And if there is it up to us? Did we cause it, and can we do anything to stop it? Or is it simply the planet's cycle of freeze and boil? Blaise Pascal was born about 400 years ago. He knew nothing of climate change, but there was a big change beginning in his day, and it was a change at least as important as climate change is to us. The change in his day, of course, was about God. Put bluntly, does God exist? And you, being a brilliant, hatchet-faced, piercing, intelligent audience, are probably familiar with the way he formulated that question as four possibilities, and every human on the planet had to bet on one of those four possibilities. And on purely rational grounds, Pascal decided that the best bet was to assume that God did exist and to behave accordingly. If you were wrong, well, the worst that could happen was that you would have wasted a bit of time in church when you could have been out making whoopee. But if you bet that God did not exist, and it turned out he did, you would fry in hell for eternity. The stakes were that large. And so it is, I think, with climate change. Maybe it will turn out to be a false alarm, though I must say it doesn't look that way. In that case, the worst outcome will be that we've bought a whole lot of solar panels we never needed. But if we bet the other way and do nothing, and it turns out that we could have stopped climate change, well, not only will we fry in our own homemade hell, but we will be tortured by the pangs of remorse as well. So this lecture will go forward on the basis that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans, and that it is amenable to us acting, even though none of those things are cast iron certainties. As for cultural change, well, that may be forced on us. Cafe lattes and Saturday afternoon barbecues may well be replaced by bunkers in the backyard full of baked beans. And when the baked beans run out, there'll be instructions about which cuts of human are easiest to grill. On the other hand, we might choose to change our cultures in ways that head off that catastrophe. But one way or another, climate change, there's no question, is going to change cultures. As for writers, well, my friend the physics professor made it painfully clear that the value of non-fiction is self-evident, those writers for newspapers and magazines and clever books about climate change. So I'm going to talk about the other kinds of writers, what you might call the arty writers, memoirists, dramatists, poets, and of course novelists. It's a truism that preventing climate change is now no longer a technological problem, because scientists and engineers have given us many ways of producing clean energy. So the problem is now behavioural. This lecture should really be called Writers in a Time of Change That Isn't Happening. Now, we all know, I think, the personal, small-scale, guilty reality of those grand abstractions about saving the planet. It's leaving the hall light on because otherwise it's a bit spooky out there. It's turning the heater up rather than putting on another jumper. So we know we should be doing something, and we even know more or less what we should be doing, but we're not doing it. Just a very small-scale indication of this, how many of you in this room have solar panels on your roofs? Okay, I think maybe five. And how many pay the premium for 100% green power? Oh, well done. All of 20. It's Melbourne. Yeah, that's terrific. It's still a fairly small proportion of the audience, though. So why aren't we all changing our behaviour as individuals and as nations? Now, I've discovered in my reading for this lecture, which I was terribly pleased I'd said yes to because it made me go and do some reading that I would never have done otherwise and which has transformed my life. I've become a neuroscience bore, I'm afraid. But I've discovered that there's an entire area of psychology that's devoted to working out why we don't do the things that we ought to do. And apparently it's known as the study of heuristics and biases. Now, the book I happened to look at listed 12 ways in which we kid ourselves that everything is going to be okay and that our judgment about where things are headed can be trusted. These 12 are apparently just the ones she was interested in looking at that day. There are obviously lots more. They include, but are not limited to, hindsight bias, confirmation bias, anchoring, adjustment and contamination, scope neglect, aren't these wonderful terms? Calibration and overconfidence, that sounds like someone with an oeuvre, and the need for closure bias. At the end of her piece, this author memorably says, "People do not become any smarter just because the survival of humankind is at stake." When I first started thinking about this whole business of behaviour and why we're not changing the way we ought to, I thought that the reason we can't turn the heater down is because we humans are hardwired for amelioration. We're always looking for ways to make our lives better. Better than they were before, better than the next person's. If we weren't, I thought, we'd still be living in caves, nibbling on the occasional raw trilobite. In which case, it's easy to see why nothing's happening on preventing climate change. It's very hard to make yourself turn down the heater if you're hardwired to want to be more comfortable. It's hard to turn down your own heater when the other guy might not be turning down his. And with every improvement that we make with our incredibly ingenious lives, our notion of the tolerable shrinks. Even in my lifetime, I've seen my notion of the tolerable shrink. The idea of living in an unheated house in, say, Canberra or Hobart is unthinkable, or an un-air-conditioned house in Darwin. And yet the house that I live in Canberra was built in 1964, and it was built with virtually no heating. That means that people must have put a lot of jumpers on. But, you know, that is now considered third world. So I thought that we were all on about constantly trying to make our lives better, innovating to improve things. But then I remembered a story told to me by a friend who's a filmmaker. She was making a documentary about the Afar people in Africa, which is the hottest place in the world and, of course, one of the driest. Every day at exactly 1:30, the goat herds take the goats out to pasture. Now, the filmmakers were running late. Naturally, one hardly needs to say that if one knows anything about filmmakers. So they asked the people if they would take the goats out at 2:00 rather than 1:30. And it turned out that that was entirely impossible. The goats went out at 1:30. They'd always been taken out at 1:30. Taking the goats out at 1:30 was an immutable part of Afar culture. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense when you see photos of the region of the world that they live in. For the Afar, the margin for error is zero. Over generations, taught by who knows what unimaginable disasters, the Afar had worked out that the safest time to take the goats out was 1:30. Innovation, which carries with it necessarily a risk of failure, was a luxury that their environment did not allow them. So I had to rethink. It seems that we're not hardwired for one kind of behaviour over another. We're not necessarily hardwired for always looking for a better way of living. We're hardwired for learning from experience. Once we've learned from experience, we then lock it in, as the Afar have, with the glue of culture. And as I understand it, this is exactly what neuroscience is discovering. There's a mechanism at work in the brain which I can only half understand. I've understood it when I read it, but if I was challenged now to explain it, I think I wouldn't be able to. But anyway, this is what this man says. This mechanism rewards correct predictions, and it also gets very excited and troubled and produces a whole lot of interesting chemicals if our expectations are wrong, if we predict wrongly. And these things make us able to learn from experience. We suck it and see, basically. Or, as this bloke puts it rather more elegantly, the brain cells measure the mismatch between expectation and outcome. They use their inevitable errors to improve performance. So whatever has worked for us in the past we're going to keep doing it. In fact, I believe Gareth Evans put it rather pungently, on any spread of options, inertia will have the numbers. So it seems that the only way that we change our behaviour, which is what we need to do in this context, is by learning from experience. But the trouble is, learning from experience is a luxury that we're not going to have this time. This time, we have to change what we do before the goats die. Now, nature is a very conscientious engineer and has made sure there are redundancies in our design. Every good engineer assumes that one span of the bridge is going to fall down and makes it strong enough that it can withstand that redundancies. So we have two kidneys, we have two eyes, we can store glucose in the muscles as well as the liver. So we might ask, did clever nature know that there would be times when learning from experience wasn't going to cut the mustard? Did she provide us with some other bit of hardwiring? Like many of you here probably, I was once a smoker. Or am I the only person in that room that has to confess to that? Mine was not a heavy habit, but it was one I couldn't seem to break. The thing was, I knew all the stuff about lung cancer. I knew all the information and I believed it. I knew the scientists were right. But it couldn't stop me smoking. In other words, intellect, information, the smart part of the brain was not enough to stop me lighting up. I'm glad to say I don't smoke now, so something obviously changed, and I can actually remember the moment at which it happened. It was, of course, about a young man that I rather fancied, a bit of a hippie, bit of a health fanatic, and we were getting on famously until one day, absent-mindedly, I lit up in front of him, and I can still see the look on his face. Utter shock, bewilderment, and disgust. He took a step back and I watched him recalibrating his idea of me. And I might add, crossing me off his list of possible girlfriends. What happened in those few seconds of me watching his face was powerful enough to make me do something that no amount of cleverness had made me do. That afternoon, I chucked away the packet of drum and I started running instead of smoking. I'm ashamed to say I don't still run, but at least I don't smoke. So what was it that happened in that moment that let me do something, change my behaviour in a way that I couldn't before? It was something to do with emotion and specifically the emotional response of empathy. I watched myself through his eyes. I felt myself as disgusting because I felt his disgust as my own. That broke through the walls of resistance that I had developed to the idea of quitting. I'd probably built those walls using, I would guess, calibration and overconfidence bias, just at a guess. That empathy gave me a new perspective, which was not a cognitive one, but an emotional one. So what I think is that nature, in fact, has given us another way, another mechanism, besides the learning from experience one, for making us change. And the way that mechanism works has something to do with emotion. And nature really is amazing. I'm reading James Lovelock's book about Gaia at the moment, which is quite, I don't know if any of you have read that, it is awe-inspiring in its a depiction of the interlockedness of the chemical basis for life. So nature is clever, and she has given us a tool for harnessing that emotional response. And she has provided people who happen to be experts at building just that kind of tool. As you would probably guess, I think that tool is art. And those people skilled at building that tool are artists. A while ago, I was in Canberra walking around one of the parks by the lake. And I came across, I could see it in a distance, obviously some kind of artwork, a series of white poles of different heights. I came closer and I read a sign that told me that it was a memorial to the SIV, that is, Suspected Illegal Entry Vehicle, X. When SIV X sank, it took with it, the sign told me, 146 mothers, 142 children and 65 fathers, all of whom drowned. And the sign proclaimed that our message in making this memorial is that kindness is stronger than fear. It was a powerful sign and a powerful bit of artwork. Yes, I thought, very worthy, very true. How sad. Then I walked closer, and the poles somehow doubled back on themselves to enclose a little bit of grass. And to get close enough to read a second sign, I actually went into that little enclosed space. And the second sign told me this: the CivX vehicle vessel was 20 metres long. The exact dimensions are outlined by these 42 poles. I glanced to the right, where the curving row of poles met, and to the left, where they met at the other end, and realised that I was standing in the middle of a boat that had somehow, along with me, contained 399 other people, all but 47 of whom had drowned. How can I tell you what I felt in that second, which I'm feeling even now, remembering that moment? Rather than give it words like terror, grief, sadness, outrage, etc., let me tell you what happened to me physically. My throat closed so that I wasn't sure that I could go on breathing. Something happened around my middle, a kind of butterflies in the stomach feeling, something sort of tremulous and frantic. My eyes seemed to darken so that the colours of the morning were bleached into black and white. I felt my face lengthen as all the muscles let go and my jaw sagged. The sun was still shining, but I was suddenly very cold. All I wanted to do was to lie down and roll into a ball and howl. Now, all this happened without my choosing. It was an effect that the reading of the numbers had not achieved, nor had the worthy words about kindness. As I stood on that patch of Canberra grass, I went through an experience beyond my control. So what's going on in that moment when art takes us into a place where all normal thinking is suspended? What it feels like is that the brain is turning from one kind of mode to another, as if a switch is thrown, and understanding is finding another path, not the path of cognition, but another more concealed, more obscure, less articulatable one. I learned recently what neuroscience is discovering about how we learn to read. You see, I have become a neuroscience bore. Apparently, we're hardwired for language. That's embedded in our brains. But we're not hardwired for reading. So when we're first confronted with the challenge of reading, our brain has no ready-made path for it, as it apparently does for language. What the brain apparently does is run around. I picture a little gnome in there running around, grabbing useful bits from all the other bits of the brain, the bit that's to do with seeing, the bit that's to do with visualising, all these bits of existing circuitry which are made for other purposes. And that clever little goblin cobbles together those functions and combines them in a new way. And that is how it makes a new tool, if you like, to do this thing called reading. Once we've learnt to read, we no longer have to do that hard work. We don't have to run around every time, because once we've learnt to read, all those little bits and pieces get cobbled together into a permanent new pathway, a shortcut that's called, you know, it's labelled reading. For reading, enter here. So it seems that in the most literal way, learning to read actually creates new brain circuitry, creates a new tool in the neurons. Now, the neuroscientists I was reading did not extrapolate that idea to the art experience, but I am boldly prepared to. Confronted with a rich piece of art, oblique, original, surprising, perhaps even obscure, the brain has no ready-made circuitry to process it. So, as it did with the challenge of learning to read, the brain will run around and put a whole lot of pre-existing circuitry together in new ways. If I'm right, experiencing art can literally create new circuits. New circuits are new ways of thinking, new tools that the brain can then apply to other purposes. So that feeling that we have, that a work of art has flipped the switch over to some new kind of thinking, appears to be literally true. Art is that powerful. It can change the brain. Any neuroscientists in this audience may tell me later that I've got the neuroscience all wrong, but I think there is a truth in this. And I have only to say that Kafka got to it before I did, and he's probably smarter than I was. Now, he was a man with an oeuvre. And Kafka said, a book is an axe for the frozen sea within us. Now, if that's not a description of setting up new brain circuitry, I don't know what is. This is a tiny bit from the novel called Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson. She had married the silent Methodist Edmund, who wore a necktie and suspenders even to hunt wildflowers, and who remembered just where they grew from year to year, and who dipped his handkerchief in a puddle to wrap the stems, and who put out his elbow to help her over the steep and stony places with a wordless and impersonal courtesy. The rising of the spring stirred a serious, mystical excitement in him and made him forgetful of her. He would pick up eggshells, a bird's wing, a jawbone, the ashy fragment of a wasp's nest. He would peer at each of them with the most absolute attention and then put them in his pockets where he kept his jackknife and his loose change. He would peer at them as if he could read them and pocket them as if he could own them. This is death in my hand. This is ruin in my breast pocket where I keep my reading glasses. At such times, he was as forgetful of her as he was of his suspenders and his Methodism. But all the same, it was then that she loved him best, as a soul all unaccompanied, like her own. Well, for some of you, that passage would have been just words and not especially interesting ones at that. For others, it might have touched some string within and set it resonating, as it did with me. And that's one of the things about art. People disagree about it. You could almost say, if it doesn't make people argue, it's not art. And it's not just because it's ambiguous. There's something else going on as well, I think. And that is that each of us brings our own experiences, our prejudices, our memories to a work of art. Each of us looks at that through that unique lens. So we all heard the same words when I read that bit of Housekeeping, but we all saw different things in our mind's eye. In that sense, the work is made freshly by each reader, and each reader is enriched in a way specific to them. Now, far from being a weakness with art, I think that's one of its great sources of power. Each time the work of art enters a new consciousness, it shifts its shape to engage with what is already in that consciousness. To use another scientific analogy that will probably horrify any biochemists here, I might as well have a clean sweep, having probably horrified the neuroscientists. My theory is you can liken the artwork to a virus. Now, a virus has an interesting quality. It has no DNA of its own. It can't replicate itself on its own. What it has to do is get into a cell and actually hijack the DNA in the cell. And it can then start its evil process of producing more swine flu. Now, I think art, this is a good analogy for art. Art enters the host, and to use the words of a biochemical book, it multiplies by pirating the metabolic machinery of the host cell. Now, one of the things that means is that it has the effect of fooling the body's response to a foreign body, because once it starts to replicate, it doesn't feel like a foreign body. It's using your own DNA. It feels like part of yourself, and therefore it won't be rejected, although hopefully swine flu is at some point. I didn't get that far in the book. But with art, I mean, that's exactly how it feels, isn't it? When you make a work of art, when you really feel deeply about a work of art, it feels as if you made it yourself, and in a way you did. In a way, the artwork, you can say, I have made that artwork mine, but actually I think it's the other way around. It has made us it. Auden put it much more deftly. He said, a real book is not one that we read, but one that reads us. So let's go back to this idea of resisting change. It begins to look as though art might have a couple of unique qualities that could be relevant to that. One, it can change brains. And two, once it's broken through and changed the brains, that new way of thinking doesn't feel like something that's come from the outside. So that means that perhaps we do, after all, have tools that can break through the ice pack of hindsight bias, confirmation bias, scope neglect, and the need for closure bias. You might say this puts a pretty heavy responsibility on artists. Does this mean that we should all be writing books about putting on another jumper and sonnets about turning the hall light off? Well, sure, if that's the way our creative impulses direct us. But I don't think that art can be done to order. The most powerful art, in my opinion, comes from somewhere other than a conscious desire to persuade. Our job is to break the ice pack, to create a different kind of response, one that's beyond the sort of oppositional positions of the intellect, the yes it is, no it isn't kind of debate. Those debates can be argued forever, and in the case of climate change, no one can actually prove anything about climate change until after it's happened, by which time, of course, it will be far too late for the human race. Art, it seems to me, offers a way beyond those deadlocks of the reason and the intellect. It creates, so to speak, a climate in which things can be understood in another way. And I think our job as artists is to offer that alternative way of responding. Our job, I think, is to break the ice, allowing information and ideas in. Those information and ideas will, I think, come from other places. Because the other thing is there is a law of diminishing returns on preaching. In fact, having been speaking for 30 minutes, I can feel it happening to myself. I think we do need books that can put pictures and words to the unimaginable, and Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road, leaps to mind. But you have to be impelled to write it. I don't think we all have a responsibility to do that. But I think there is one responsibility we have, because as writers, we are also citizens and we are voters. We are privileged with education and the skills of both reading and writing. We ought to have the gift of the gab as writers. That means, I think, that our responsibility is to get ourselves informed as much as we can about the debates around climate change, gigawatt hours and so on. I mean, that's why I'm going to these lectures on geothermal power. I'm trying. Because we need to be able to refute the arguments of the climate change sceptic in the supermarket queue ahead of us. We need to be able to write a convincing letter to the paper or even more to our MPs, one in particular who springs to mind. And as public figures of a kind, I think we probably have a responsibility to act on our beliefs in whatever public ways we can. But I think perhaps our greatest contribution might be in recognising that we have some specialised skills and habits that might be useful in a time of climate change. These are the skills that artists use. They're the skills that lets art bubble up from wherever it bubbles up from. They're not usually actually called skills. They're often called things like daydreaming and, having inspiration, rather condescending and patronising words like that. But I think we do have these slightly different ways of problem solving which we can offer. To begin with, we work around the edges of our culture and around the edges of the proper economy, where we're used to working because of some passion attached to the work itself, not just for money or personal gain. In other words, we're a bit weird. Our values overlap with the values of our culture, but they're not identical. You might say we're in our culture, but we're not quite of it. And I think what that means is that writers or artists in general are very often seem to sense or articulate a bit ahead of time what's about to happen. It's as if we pick up the first zephyrs of the wind of change and push them forward, give them words or pictures into the consciousness of the wider society. Artists also know about the truth that can be found in untruth. We take bits and pieces from the culture around us and put them together in ways they were never intended for. Bits of science, bits of magic, bits of past, bits of the future. The ways we put them together are wrong, but they're also right. Historians know more about the past, scientists know more about the future than we do. What we know about is the continuous present of the puzzle of being humans, the mysteries of why we are the way we are, and why we do the things we do. Would any man picking up the ashy fragment of a wasp's nest really think, this is death in my hand and ruin in my breast pocket? Well, in art, the answer is always both yes and no. Metaphor is the currency of art, and that's a coinage that has no measurable exchange rate. As Emily Dickinson says it so beautifully, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success is in circuit lies. Writers also have ways of going into the darkest places and taking their readers with them, but coming out safely again. All those clever ways of not looking at the truth that the psychologists know about are really ways of not going into the dark place. And with reason, it's scary in there. It might overwhelm us. But without the process of mourning, which I think involves plunging into that dark place and walking through it until we get to somewhere else, we are doomed to the paralysis of melancholia. And specifically, in the shadow of the change bearing down on us, we have to confront what we're about to lose, not just kind of turn away helplessly. Writers also might be able to have a go at rescuing the language from eco-vandals, or at least to shout out our outrage at how language is being hijacked. How can a shopping bag made of thick strands of woven plastic really be green, even if it is coloured green? What are eco-baked beans? And what about the corruption of thinking embedded in this advertisement for air conditioning that I saw recently, creating climate change in your own home? How dare they? The other thing is, I think we're very good at a particular sort of problem solving, which I think of as the top of the fridge problem solving. What it is this: you've lost your car keys. You know they're somewhere in the house because the car is sitting out there on the driveway. And you go through everything, you come back in the door again with another set of keys and try, you know, all the tricks of the rational mind to think, what the hell did I do with those keys? And you work yourself up into a lather. And in fact, the other day on the radio, I heard a piece of music and I realised that Beethoven has written the soundtrack for this bit of your day. It's a wonderful little piece called Rage Over a Lost Penny. Anyway, finally you give up, and in order to hopefully lower your blood pressure, you do the dishes. And just as you're balancing the white plate against the blue mug and thinking, I must get more detergent, it comes to you. The keys are on top of the fridge. No thinking, no going through anything, just a holistic moment of watching yourself put the keys on the top of the fridge. Now, what is that? It is the most useful thing which we all use every day. Life could not go on without it. And yet, does it have a name, that kind of intelligence? If anything, it's inspiration, intuition, you know, these ironic, patronising labels. We do not get diplomas in that kind of thinking, and yet we probably should. But this kind of problem solving is where the answers to the toughest problems come from. And it seems to be that artists are experts at that. This is our stock in trade, this kind of thinking. You cannot think your way into a work of art. You have to almost surrender yourself to something, that sort of it that knows where your keys are, in order to let that artwork bubble up. And again, the neuroscientists, I believe, have a thing. It's called a sophisticated resonance effect in the prefrontal cortex, which apparently keeps a whole lot of stuff bouncing around in there together. I imagine a bit like those lotto balls in the thing. And as long as you can shut up the rest of your brain by doing something like doing the dishes, those bouncing balls will eventually present you with your lotto prize where the keys are. In the world of art that cannot be hurried and cannot be forced, I think artists understand the deep truth of that wonderful, ironic Polish proverb, sleep fast, we need the pillows. I was going to talk at this point about the fact that there is resistance to the... Perhaps I will. Will I? How am I going for time?
Beautiful. Keep going.
Okay. Not much longer. I don't usually talk at this length. I feel I've kind of gone on long enough. Okay. So there's resistance to this message that coal is too cheap, but it seems to me that there is also a dangerous resistance to the message that artists can actually do something about it. you know, 200 years ago, Shelley said, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Well, these days he'd be laughed out of the room, I think. Several things have happened. I'm just going to mention two of them. First of all, on the grounds of irrelevancy and elitism, hundreds of years worth of our literary and other art heritage is being allowed to fade. It's not relevant, it's too hard. Even when it is taught, and I'm thinking of literature here, its blade is blunted by being presented only in its immediately understandable dimensions, the journey, the individual and society. That's one problem. The other is that the boundaries of what is permitted seem to be being patrolled, as Louise mentioned, by a kind of genre police, demanding to see the passports of various bits of writing. Are you fiction or non-fiction? Are you history or did you just make it all up? This is sad, but the worst thing about it is that the ideas, and what's more, the kind of deep engagement that might happen between the reader and that artwork, disappear behind this barrage of pointless stuff about labelling, so that the ideas themselves become lost. And I think this resistance comes from the fact that art goes into places in the psyche that are not comfortable to be in. Art gets into your vitals and turns you inside out. That bit of lawn in Canberra was not a comfortable place to be. So the resistance is a quite understandable impulse to control and to reduce the great, frightening, overwhelming chaos of art to the comfortable, the bland, and the comprehensible. Difficult art is like the spinach that your mother, if you were lucky, made you eat as a child. You didn't enjoy it and you didn't see the point. But if those vitamins and minerals were inserted into your molecules at that age, they are there then for you to draw on in later life. Thank you, Mum, for all the spinach and lamb's fry. And I think art is a bit the same. If you have not been exposed to the idea that there might be works of art that you don't quite understand, that go on resonating and puzzling and sort of itching away at you, if you haven't been exposed to that idea, then your brain has not been challenged to make any new pathways, and you have not had the humility and the exhilaration of discovering that if you worry away, if you allow yourself to just stay with that feeling of this puzzling artwork, something might happen to you, something might change, something interesting might happen. So that means that young people who are going to be on the front line of this appalling stuff that's going to happen in our future are the very ones that have been denied that sort of artistic spinach. They only know things that can be readily quantified and readily understood. If it's not either of those two things, they kind of don't have any practice at dealing with it. That seems to be a bad thing. Cicero, to quote another great man, put it in a nutshell: he who knows only his own generation remains always a child. What's ahead of us will definitely need grown-ups on the job. So, at that point, I was going to read a wonderful poem, which was my mother's favourite poem, but I'm not going to read it. I'm going to ask you to go home and read it. This was her favourite poem. It's called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, and it is, in fact, a poem about change. It's a poem about how art can take us into a moment where we stand, as it says here, when a new planet swims into... I felt like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific and with all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. That wild surmise, I think, is what art can do. So I recommend you go and read the poem. If writers and writing are to have any part in this time of change, if we're going to be, as they say, stakeholders in it, I think our first task is to assert that we do have something to contribute. Let's recognise the power of art to bring about change at the molecular level of the organism. As writers, let us pick up that axe that Kafka mentions and hone it to a fine old edge. Let's hoist it up onto our shoulders and swing it with a mighty arm. Let us write with passion. Let us write deeply into the mysterious folds of the human interior. Let us write as if it matters, because it does. Thanks.
It's interesting that there are two devices on the lectern that Kate and I studiously avoided thinking about or picking up. We haven't got a clue what they are, but they're gadgets that I watched Kate trying to push away. So I think they're part of the technology to do with that, but so we'll just put them over there for the moment. Kate, while you were talking, this wonderful exhortation, a kind of exhortation to us to remember the role of art, I kept thinking about John Mortimer and his acerbic comment that the life of the modern writer is somewhere between the yogurt and the milk. And I think you've kind of argued the case against such a kind of trite view of arts, the arts, artists, and the role they play in our society. It's a dazzling lecture, and I want to thank you very much, and I'm sure the audience will join me again. Kate has kindly agreed to take some questions, and I think there are microphones available if people have some questions. I think there's a microphone. Is there a microphone? There is a microphone coming if you just...
I've enjoyed this week thoroughly, but I've got to say that would probably be the highlight so far for me.
Thank you.
I too like quotes, although I'm not very good at who to attribute them to. One I like is, "He who knows the cost of everything knows the value of nothing." Unfortunately, I see the education system from an early age being all about knowing the cost of things, and you've certainly touched on the desperate need for people to understand the value. Do you see that we have the time frame to turn things around in that regard?
You're speaking of education or...?
Yes.
Right. Yes, I think it's never too late to turn... it seems to me that education, it's a big ship. It takes a long time to... Is this sound
it's
weird?
Fine. It's fine.
It's all right, okay. But it can be done. I mean, you know, the education system in Ireland, I believe, was turned around within much less than one generation when Ireland joined the EU. Huge amounts of money and thought and ingenuity were pumped into the education system. Yes, it's never too late. Yeah, let's go out there and change it.
Questions? Other questions? Well, while we're waiting, I might ask one, if that's all right. Kate, I was interested in your, in a way, pushing back slightly on the idea of the artist as political activist, if you like, a kind of small amount of hesitation around that. We published a book, that a collection of essays called Authors Take Sides, a collection that had been originated in the UK during the Spanish Civil War. And in this instance, we were publishing responses to the Gulf. This was the Gulf War and then the Iraq War. And I remember ringing Frank Morehouse and asking him if he'd contribute. And he said to me, "Why don't you publish a collection called Dentists Take Sides? Why are you asking artists?" And I said, well, he had obviously not met my dentist. He would know the reason why you wouldn't go to a dentist. But I wondered, I wondered whether, you know, why that reservation in your speech around the idea of the artist as, you know, not just the crude idea of the artist as activist, but the artist as engaged artist, I guess, is the question.
Mm. Yeah, look, I think we do have to be engaged, but maybe not as artists. I think maybe there's a distinction between us as, I mean, I do believe, for me anyway, that art can't be... I mean, I can't think of a single book of kind of polemic, fiction or polemic, that has ever shifted me one iota. In fact, I think I resist it, because I think you are dressing up an argument as a piece of literature. I want to have the argument. Let's have the argument straight. Come out from behind the scenes. On the other hand, I think that, unlike dentists, writers do have a bit of leverage in the community, and I think that's our power as activists.
As opposed to
not
revulsion,
much, but a little bit.
Revulsion trauma. Yes. Yes, that's right. But Joan, hate to harp on a favourite of mine, but Joan Makes History is an argument. That's a kind of, a kind of claim to reinsert women into the story of Australia. That's a pretty political... It was a political gesture on your part. I think it was written... Was it in response to the bicentennial? No, it was written prior to the bicentennial,
yeah.
Lead up to the bicentennial. That was pretty political.
It is, that's true. In a way, though, the politics came later. I mean, I had spent the childhood that many of us did growing up in the 50s and 60s as a female, railing against a world in which, you know, boys had all the fun, basically. And that's where most of those individual scenes came from, a kind of... you know, I used to think of it as drawing moustaches on the people in the history books, a kind of anarchic desire to say, no, this is not how history is. And in a way, the thinking came later. I mean, I'd been thinking all that, I'd even been writing fragments of it, and then the Bicentennial came along with all its sort of very, you know, full of mateship and a lot of blokey stuff, which again seemed to be about to leave out all sorts of groups, of which women and Indigenous people were too. And only then I thought, perhaps I can shape this stuff, which is just an instinctive response to my life as a woman. Maybe I can actually funnel that through some kind of idea funnel and make a book about ideas. But I think the stuff has to come first, and then you can see what it means. That's how it works for me anyway.
Other questions? Yes.
I really enjoyed the theme that you...
Hang on one second, the mic is going to come through.
Thank you. I did very much enjoy the theme of your talk about artists in many ways using their skills and their talents to put the mirror up to society and to identify what needs to be changed and in a special way, in a... As an art, mm-hmm. to make it easily accessible and entertaining and get right into the subconscious. So I know, looking back at the history of literature, there's been, you know, a great many dystopias written, like the one that jumped to mind was, say, 1984, with put that expression, Big Brother, mm-hmm. into the, you know, how many times do we use that expression as against totalitarianism? I wonder, where is the... I haven't seen a dystopia about climate change yet or that sort of thing. I'd just like to hear your reflection on, are there some authors saying that now?
Well, my publisher told me the other day that they are, and probably all publishers, are being inundated with hundreds and thousands of not very good dystopias about climate change. Some of them probably will be good. I mean, The Road by Cormac McCarthy is not specifically a climate change dystopia, but it's probably got something to do with that. I think we'll probably see quite a lot of that. Have there been any good ones? Can anybody recommend some?
Kim Robinson. I was just going to say a writer called Kim Robinson, who's actually not a fabulous writer, but the trilogy is compelling despite that. It's about a three-part series.
What you say is interesting because I think, like 1984, it's probably not great literature. It's great ideas are put in a kind of slightly sugar-coated form, and maybe that's... That, for me, is verging on non-fiction. It's like non-fiction dressed up as fiction, and there's a place for that because it does get under people's radar and you can read it for pleasure. But to me, art does something different, which is not about the subject matter that the book or the artwork is about, but that moment at which the artwork kind of hits you between the eyes and you stop thinking, in a way, and you enter some other realm where you're kind of open in some almost vulnerable way. That seems to me a difference. The two, I think, we need them all, but I think there is a distinction.
J.G. Ballard's Drought, which was in 64, does both. It's one of the... Mm. Yeah. And yeah. Steve Amsterdam, which has just come out, I think, about...
So the list goes on, you see, it's a plethora. Yeah. There's another question. Thanks, Sophie. There's another question up here, yes.
Kate, I just wanted to, just thinking about climate change in the future, you know, so writing novels set in the future, but so much of your work has been concerned with history in the past, and I just wanted to say, what is it that drives you to concern your artistic expression with history? What is it about the past that makes you sit down and write?
I think it's because, I'm not all that interested in the past per se. I'm absolutely not a historian. But for me, the past is a way, it's a kind of a back door into understanding the present and perhaps even the future. For one thing, in order to understand the present, obviously you have to go back and unknot that knot, and that's going to have happened some time ago. But also there's a kind of, there is a kind of under the radar feeling about using history. We know that these things happened, and because history is only ever a partial record, I'm thinking of the book I've just written, The Lieutenant, which leaves a very partial record of a man's relationship with an Indigenous girl. The gaps in that are really what it's about. And in writing into those gaps, which historians would, you know, legitimately probably not be able to write into those gaps to the extent that a novelist can boldly do, you can illuminate something about the present in a way that is less... what is it? There's something about writing about the past that puts it in high relief, and you can you're prepared to understand it in the past. Perhaps it's not cluttered up by too much empathising with the kind of the texture of the reality. If you set it in today, people are inclined to think, oh, it's not really like that, or yes, I did something like that the other day. If it's in the past, you can sort of deal with the issues. I think I've expressed that extremely badly. Perhaps I should just say, I don't really know, except that I find the past fascinating.
We've got another question here. Sorry, just down here, thank you. Second row, just here.
I don't want to bring any negativity to a talk that was so inspiring and so positive, but I wanted to make some comment about the concept of learning from experience. And I think what you contrasted was learning from experience sounds like such a positive thing, and your experience in the park in Canberra obviously had a huge impact. But I often think about learning, that experience can kind of lock you into not learning from experience, that it becomes the obstacle that prevents you from actually taking in anything new and being receptive to something like what you experienced. And I wondered if you could say something about that, especially in terms of turning down the heater and turning off the lights. That's the kind of trivial, in some way, examples, but I was thinking about more universal changes that people need to make to really make a difference. That often experience stops new history happening.
Mm. Well, I think that's right. I think that's the one form of hardwiring, the learning from experience, like the Afar taking the goats out, which it's a very protective mechanism in a way. It's about doing what's worked in the past. But I think what I was trying to say was that art can actually offer something else, which is not learning from experience, but learning from some kind of shock that jerks you out of everything you've ever known, like that moment on the lawn there, and that is beyond anything you have ever known or could ever know. It breaks that frozen sea. That's clearly what we need, because, as you say, there is a... what's worked in the past, we're just going to keep on doing it. I mean, until we also are overwhelmed by Hurricane Katrina or something, we're not really going to think about it. For a week we might, there are bushfires in Victoria. For a week we think, oh dear, climate change, we better turn down the heater. A week later we're back to our bad old ways. I don't know. I mean, the psychologists' barrage of ways in which we rationalise behaviour that we know we shouldn't be doing is somewhat frightening. We really are hardwired for excellent rationalising.
One more question I think we've got time for. Nope. Yes, there's one here, sorry.
Not so much a question as a statement, I suppose, but I'm just thinking Stephen Amsterdam's book, Things We Didn't See Coming, had a similar impact on me as The Secret River in terms of generating discomfort And I think that that's, if artists can do that about this issue, then that's much more in so much more imaginative way than simply a polemic that tells us what not to do. And that is something that artists do have the ability to do, and I guess that we need to keep trying to achieve.
Yes, discomfort, but sugared with the pill of such beauty or narrative force that they keep on reading. I mean, the problem with discomfort is we tend to turn away from it. That's the paradox and the challenge for us, I think.
Well, I think we better close the evening there. I just wanted to say that I was thinking while Kate was talking about the way in which art moves us, I always like to keep in mind, I think it's a book you probably know, Alberto Manuel. He wrote a book called The History of Reading, and he talks about a tutor that he had when he was a little boy in Buenos Aires who would insist that he memorise poetry, the poetry of Goethe and Schiller in particular, and Alberto Manuel didn't understand why he was being forced to do this, and he finally got up the courage to ask his tutor why he should do this, and the tutor said, well, it's because I understand the point of memorising poetry because I found myself in a concentration camp called Sachsenhausen, and I was in that dark and despairing environment. People would come up to me knowing that I had been an academic and ask me to read to them. Of course, there were no books to be read from, so he would open the description, and I'm sorry to paraphrase it so inelegantly, but the description was, the tutor describes how he would open himself up as a book and recite from Euripides or Shakespeare or Sophocles. In that dark and despairing place, he would, in this act of redemption, bring to life that literature again. And I wanted to say to you that I thought it was a great act of redemption that you're describing to us as an artist and a writer. So thank you very much, Kate. Please join me in thanking her.